Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance FIL 240 for spring semester 2026.
Okay, today, financial statement. Bear with me one moment. Look at the numbers. I apologize for being off to a little rough start here. Things are a little odd. But what has been happening? There are two different views, very different. A bull view is going on right now. Stocks are a great investment, buy and all that. And then there is another group of investors that are absolutely convinced that we're on the edge of a real crash in the market. Right now, the bulls are in charge on the other side of the world. You can see that the Tokyo was in a bad mood. It dropped on the opening, but really from there, there was no more information, positive or negative, so it just basically floated for the rest of the day. And the Hang Seng, it just kind of just floated at about zero all day. It's not really a lot going any either way. But then you get over here and you get over to the European exchanges, like the Paris exchange, you see the CAC 40. It started out sliding, but then it recovered. But then at the end, it just dropped again. So it's kind of hard to say. And notice that the Financial Times, London, it dropped right off the start, but then it rose and then it dropped again too. So it was just kind of one of those days where nothing really happened. By the end, you had hardly any movement up or down in these. But over here on this side of the Atlantic, you had the Dow was up almost 0.75%. The S&P 500 was interestingly up not as much. Usually it would be up a little more, but it was up almost 0.75%. And the NASDAQ, which usually should be the highest of them, was the lowest of them. So it's hard to really tell what's going on that side. This was all bullish market activity. But then you get down here and we look at these numbers. Gold cut through $5,000 an ounce, and it did have a sell-off at the end today. Right now, gold doesn't follow the same path time frame as stocks, but it's still well above $5,000 an ounce, and that is just, that's those gold investors thinking that the world is going to come to an end. I had a number of talks over the weekend by phone and on Zoom with a couple of traders who are former students of mine from a long time ago, and they were convinced, as were some others, that today was going to be some kind of like a black market day, because there was this combined forces were going to just cause absolute chaos in the market. Didn't happen though. So nevertheless, gold is still on its way up, even though it did have a nice drop off there at the end. Oil just seems to be holding steady right around $60 an ounce on the overall average crude price. And that means you're not going to see any prices go up or down, we hope, for a while. Now, one thing about gold or oil is that it is kind of a difficult market, because even if the supply of oil is really good, which it is right now, you can see price movements based upon supply and demand dynamics of the things that oil is turned into. So for example, about half of all oil goes to gasoline. And then another quarter of it, maybe about 25%, goes to what we call distillates. That's jet fuel, diesel, kerosene. And then the last, about a fourth, goes to products like plastics, cosmetics, pharmaceutical stuff. It's got, you know, just anything that uses hydrocarbon products. However, if there is a less than a good supply of, so say for example, diesel, you'll see diesel prices high. And what that will mean is that you're probably going to see some production shift away from making gasoline to making diesel. And of course, that will cause the price of diesel to begin to slow, fade downward, and it will cause the price of gasoline to nudge upward some in order to rebalance supply, quantity supplied with quantity demanded of diesel. So there are things that can cause gasoline prices, diesel prices, jet fuel prices, kerosene prices to move, and it's not because of the actual overall supply of oil. It's just what is needed by the different in the different markets, types of oil markets, hydrocarbon products. Now, let me take you down here real quick. This is the sector map. And right now, as you can see, overall, it's quite bullish. And that is the result of it was a good day on the street. It wasn't a spectacular day, but it was a good day. And almost, it is really unusual to see the technology sector have a red day. Even if everything else is red, technology sector might be in the green. And as you can see, most of these, it was a broad-based bull day. There were only a few markets, few sectors that were bearish. Consumer cyclicals and consumer defensives. And interestingly, energy had a little bit. It wasn't a much of a down day, but it was something of a down day. So we're kind of in a market is in a good mood right now, but it's hard to call where it's going to go from here. Who's going to be right, the bulls or the bears? Are we going to just keep seeing higher and higher stock prices, or is the end coming very soon? What I want to do is show you a couple of actual stocks today, but before I do that, I want to show you exchange-traded funds, ETFs. An ETF is essentially a portfolio, one you might even recognize, and you buy stock in the portfolio. So this first one, SPY, SPY, this is the Standard & Poor's 500. Now, if you buy a share for $693, you have bought the Standard & Poor's portfolio. You have. That's how it works. You have incredible diverse portfolio diversification. You have the portfolio managed by the experts, the people who know how to do this, and you are essentially investing in the 500 largest stocks in the country. And it's a stock, so you buy one, sell one, buy 10, sell 10. It's just another stock to you. And yet, you are owning the 500 giants of the earth by owning that ETF, one share of it. Now, there are other ones, too. There are many, many ETFs that are essentially, they are other indices. Like, you could get one that was followed the Dow 30 or the NASDAQ or about anything you want. ETFs, there are literally thousands of ETFs out there. And you are essentially buying a well-managed portfolio, and you don't have to go through all of the gyrations day in and day out of keeping your portfolio balanced using control portfolio control theory, all of that. It's not your problem. You've got it right here in one of these. Now, as you can see, the SPDR is rather pricey. It's almost $700 a share. But as the S&P 500 goes up, your stock, the ETF SPY, goes up with it. Same movements as far as percentage up and down goes. Now, and that would be the same that for these other ETFs, exchange-traded funds, which I mentioned in the last lecture on Wednesday of last week. Now, one thing about this, and I've really got to check with some of my trader associates, this was unheard of back in the day, but you can now buy a fraction of a share of stock. You can buy a tenth of a SPDR. Here's one of the best investing pieces of advice that's out there. Don't go buying based upon number of shares. Buy on a dollar basis, using the same amount of money every time you put money into the stock market. So if you decide every month I want to put in $100, You do that, that's called dollar averaging. What happens when you do this is that you will, and when stock prices are low, your $100 will buy more stock. When stock prices are high, your $100 will buy less stock. This is exactly what you would want to do as an intelligent investor. Buy low, and don't buy as much when the prices are high. So if you really wanted, for example, to buy Spider, and again, I'm going to have to, I'll check this over this evening. You can just put, okay, I want to buy $100 worth of SPY, or SPDR it is. And that means that over a period of years, you just keep putting in dollar averaging. When this S&P 500 is very high, you're not buying very many, your $100 isn't going to buy you much of a share. When the S&P 500 is low, you'll be buying more of the S&P 500. So over a long period of time, that kind of investing, and I'll show you the numbers much later in the course, you can end up with literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars just because you maintain the discipline of dollar average investing. Just something to think about. And I'll show you other ETFs, and I'll also show you some mutual funds that are kind of fun too. But buying single individual stocks is really not a good idea because you're not getting portfolio diversification nearly as quickly as you would if you just buy an ETF, which is already a diversified portfolio. Now, let me take you on a little bit of a journey just to show you a few numbers. I'm going to take a couple of stocks here. Verizon, VZ. Now, one thing to, before I show you any numbers, is this. Mobile phones are an absolute necessity of life on the level of toothpaste, soap, toilet paper. Madam, what would you do if you were no longer allowed to have a mobile phone? You'll probably kill yourself. I know, right? I gotta have it. It's so necessary. So what would you expect the beta to be on Verizon? A high beta above one or a low beta below one? Just what would you expect, just off the top of your head? Yes, exactly. Safe. It is a very safe investment. If we go over here and have a look at Verizon, well, I'll be darned if Verizon, yep, 0.33. In other words, in a well-diversified portfolio, Verizon moves only a third as much as the entire market. Take a look back here at the Spider. The Spider is basically the market. Its beta is exactly one. Where the heck is the beta? Really? Oh, there it is. It is exactly the market. It is the market, so it has 100% of the volatility of the market. Whereas Verizon, an individual stock, in this case, in a well-diversified portfolio, this thing swings only as a third as much as the market. Now, a couple of things that I want to point out here to you. First of all, you would buy Verizon at $39.72 a share. You would sell Verizon stock, if you had it, at a little less, $39.70. So in other words, the bid-ask spread on this stock today is 2 cents. Now, that changes from day to day, even minute to minute in some cases. Take you on a couple of more other ones here. Now, over the last 52 weeks, the average volume on Verizon has been about 27.5 million shares per day, on average over the last year. Today, it is very weak volume. It's, well, there's still some time left, trading time left, but it's barely half of the volume on a typical day. So in other words, this is a very quiet stock today. There's not nearly as much buying and selling as usual on this stock. It's just parked waiting for something to happen. And I'm going to take you down here. This measure, P-E ratio, this number, price divided by earnings, says how much are investors willing to pay to get $1 of earnings from the company. Right now, they're willing to pay $8.47 because they believe that each dollar of earnings that belong to the shareholder will turn into $8.47 over time. That's what it says. Now, usually, PE ratios, you want to look at the industry average PE ratio, which I have, but I'll show that to you in another class, as a general rule of thumb. Anything below a PE ratio of 30 is considered undervalued. Above 30 would be overvalued. And again, that is, you have to look at the industry's PE ratio average, but 30 is kind of a good place to start. So in this case, we can see that Verizon is undervalued right now. And I talked about undervalued and overvalued relative to intrinsic value last week. So here we have a stock that is undervalued and is quite safe as an investment. Now here's another thing about it. This dividend here, forward dividend and yield. The 2.76, I should say, that's the amount of a check you will get as a dividend if you buy if you own a share of Verizon. So when you take that $2.76 and divide it by $39.74, you get what the number in parentheses, the yield on the dividend. So in other words, even if Verizon price does not go up or down at all, you will earn a return on the stock of 6.98% by virtue of the dividend you get. Higher dividends tend to make betas lower because at least some of your investment is in the form of a dividend check instead of the stock price going up. So that's one of the good reasons why this is a safe stock. You're going to get a check in the mail. You put in $39.74, and you're going to get, it's not guaranteed. Dividends are not guaranteed. They're not. But you're probably going to get a check for $2.76 just because you own the share. And that's on top of what you would get from the price of the stock itself going up. That's called the capital gain. So there are two pieces to what you make off a stock. There is the capital gain, the stock price going up, we hope going up, and then there's the dividend yield, that check you get for the amount of your investment. Now, one last thing that I'm going to bring up here. There's a number right here, the market cap. This company, the market cap, that's short for capitalization. The market capitalization is the price per share, in this case, $39.74, times the number of shares outstanding of the company. It is the market's valuation of the equity of Verizon. Now, if you look at the accounting statements, and we'll talk about financial statements today, you will see that there is a number there, total shareholders' equity. Almost always, it will be a very, very different number from the market cap. Even though they're saying that they represent the same thing, the value of the total value of the equity in the company, the market cap is the one that matters. Because you are not going to buy and sell this stock or any stock from an accountant. You will buy it from the people who are trading and making these prices happen. So even though Verizon's total shareholder equity is actually quite small, comparatively speaking, the market says that Verizon, the equity of in Verizon, the total value of the ownership of Verizon is a whopping, where is that market cap again? There it is. $167.519 billion. Now that's important. However, Verizon is, well, from what I'm about to show you, Verizon is a tiny company, comparatively speaking. Let me show you the market caps of some other companies. We'll start with Alphabet, otherwise known as Google, G-O-O-G. The market cap of Google is $4.038 trillion. That's one company is worth $4 trillion. Let's look at Apple, A-A-P-L. Apple is worth $3.777 trillion. Right there, we're coming close to $8 trillion is in just two companies of the earth. Let's add in Amazon, A-M-Z-N, worth $2.558 trillion. So right there, we're working our way up toward $11, $12 trillion in just three companies. And then we can look at NVIDIA. With a market cap of $4.539 trillion. Is that a nine? Yep. So now we are walking up. It's just insane in just four companies. And none of these come even close to the biggest company of all. The Saudi Arab Oil Company, with a market cap of $6.1 trillion. So I've shown you, what, five companies approaching $20 trillion, 20-something trillion. Let me try this. Sir, how much are you worth?
Not a lot.
Compared to this, not even a speck on the radar. All of us taken together, all of the people on Earth taken together, do not constitute much of a fraction of what the 100 largest companies on Earth are worth. That is what creates the insane asymmetry of power. In fact, about 75% of all stock is owned by other companies. We don't even own about a fourth of all the stock of companies. Corporations own each other's stock. That's about 75%, according to the latest analyses that took a lot of computation to do. And it's so complicated, the interlocking ownership, that it's even past artificial intelligence right now. We'll probably be able to do it better once we get to quantum computing. But yeah, so the idea that, well, we have power, look at the numbers, follow the money, and that tells you where power is, where political, social, cultural, and all of that. Can we do anything about it? Yeah, we can invest and live our lives and let them live theirs as the giants of the earth. But that's just a caution to all of what we are doing in this class. We are looking at things that just are incomprehensible. But unlike looking at galaxies and black holes, these actually affect us, everything we do. So that's why finance is actually one of the most interesting but depressing fields out there. Okay, now, I want to go on. Today's lecture is on financial statements. In other words, This is a lecture about accounting. Now, every time I have to teach this lecture, accounting, I come into the classroom and I have to think to myself, do I really want to go in there and teach accounting, or do I just want to kill myself? And I usually, obviously, decide, okay, I'm going to teach this subject. And just as a background, I can make all the jokes about accounting that, you know, that are worth telling. But at the same time, the reality is that accounting is the foundation of all civilization. If you go on an archaeological expedition to the Middle East, the Levant, to South Asia, we find all of these clay tablets, and you know, in the movies, you find a clay tablet, and when you speak the words on it, some demon comes out. No, almost all of them are numbers and records of ownership of animals, land. They are records of transactions, cuneiform tablets by the tens of thousands or pieces of them. They are nothing but accounting records. That's it. And so what we have is essentially a foundation of transactional civilization. And the businesses, the farms, and the royalty all using numbers to record what has happened. So that gives you an idea of how important accounting is. And if you've taken the accounting classes, which most of you have seen all these rules, all of these methods, you do debits and credits and all that kind of stuff. It's ancient, it's timeless. Now, at the beginning of the age of exploration, the explorers needed capital. They had to have capital to go to other places. We had just come through the Black Plague, and the survivors were really getting hot to have new experiences. They were more defiant because so many people, a third of the population of Europe and the British Isles had been wiped out. And so they had economic power. A middle class began to show up. Merchants, guilds, and the nobles found out that they had to deal with people. They couldn't just enslave. They couldn't just order. You wanted, some nobleman says, you knave, I want you to build me a house of bricks. And he says, what are you going to pay me? I'll pay you what I always pay. No, you won't, because there aren't many of us left. And that gave them economic power. And with economic power, they began to want things. And not just boring, old, ugly stuff that everyone wore through the miserable Middle Ages, the Dark Ages. They wanted new stuff. And the only way to get all this interesting stuff was going down the Silk Road through bandits, through miserable conditions, mountains, deserts. There had to be another way. And so explorers were talking about going that way, west, to get to those great markets in China, to get great goods to bring back here. Okay, bring back to where they could be bought and sold. Okay, great. The thing was, well, at first they didn't realize there was a giant pair of connected continents in the way, and that was a bit of a surprise to them. But the bottom line was, though, they needed capital to be able to do these explorations. Christopher Columbus, his brother was going all over the place looking for money. And it turns out that the royal families, those noblemen, a lot of them were pretty cash strapped. They were borrowing from the wealthy, powerful new families that were rising in Europe. The Medicis were one family. There were many others that were making money, huge amounts of money, one way or another. So they were not just asking kings and queens for money. Christopher Columbus went to Queen Isabella to ask for some money, but his brother found an investor, a private investor, who said, "Yeah, I'm game for this, But I and the investor said, great, well, I'll fund a little of a part of your adventure. However, I will captain, I will be the commander of one of the vessels. If I pay for a vessel to go over there, I am going to run that vessel. They said, cool, that's okay. That made it less that they had to borrow from other people or beg from other people. Anyway, the point was that this got to be a mania. Explorers saying, let me go. I want to go. I need capital. I want to go over there. I can find things that these other slobs can't. As a matter of fact, a famous story, I won't go into too much detail because it gets to be awfully salacious, but Columbus's brother actually was spreading vile rumors about another explorer who was going around looking for money, for capital, I should say, long-term funds. Okay, here's the thing, though. These wealthy families were willing to play. They said, okay, tell me what you are going to do. How much do you need? What are you going to bring back? And how long is it going to take? In other words, level, timing, and how sure are you going to be, are you that you're going to get back here? Risk. Level, timing, and risk. Remember financial intermediation. Okay. The problem was that there was no organized way for these explorers to present their proposals. Now, this brings us to take reel back here, and turn around and go into a secluded monastery in Italy and go into that monastery and find a monk by the name of Pacioli. He had a vow of silence, lifetime vow of silence. So having a vow of silence and being bored out of his mind, he did something that you and I and every person who does accounting invented. He invented double ledger accounting. What you guys do, debits and credits, you know, and the trial balance, all that, double ledger. And that set the stage for a set of rules by which proposals could be made to these rich, rich people. Well, we got the revenue. We've got, here's the cost of all the different goods. Here's how much we're going to bring in from investments. Here's how much we're going to send out for the supplies we need. That means that accounting was, in a way, central to the efficient financial intermediations that would open up the new world, the age of exploration, and then from that, the age of enlightenment, which brought us to here in these academic institutions of higher learning. So when I disrespect accounting, it is certainly with the understanding that that is core to where we are in the world today. Let me show you something. The problem is that accounting produces information products for a variety of constituencies. They produce financial statements for internal management. They produce financial statements for the investors. They produce financial statements that can be viewed by external stakeholders. So there is a variety of groups that want to see the accounting statements. Finance people want to see them, but we, unlike others, tear them apart and then put them back together again. You probably were never told this in accounting, but they probably wouldn't dispute me. The core financial statement is the balance sheet. Everything else is a side calculation that comes into this balance sheet. This lake, this reservoir, is the balance sheet. So, for example, the income statement brings us to the statement of retained earnings. The statement of retained earnings flows to none other than the balance sheet. You've seen it there. The statement of cash flows that one goes through all these gyrations, which you may or may not remember investing activities, financing activities, all those kinds of things, and gets itself down to a line, surprise, at the very bottom called cash, which goes to none other than the balance sheet. Everything on those financial statements is to the culminating purpose of making the balance sheet. The balance sheet is the end result of rivers flowing, rivers of cash flow coming in to the company. Over the course of a fiscal period, these rivers flow down, and once they have captured their water, they show up here in this reservoir. That's why you hear that thing, the balance sheet is a stock of value and the income statement is a flow. Literally, these are the flowing rivers that are captured into the reservoir of the balance sheet right there. Now, here's the thing, though. The balance sheet is in itself problematic for finance people because there's a lot in those flows of those rivers that mean nothing to us because they say nothing about operations. And operations are the only way that a company can live. It's through the flow of the blood, not the pool of blood that's sitting in your body. It's through the flow of it to the parts that need it. And so we dismiss things that are obvious to the accountants and to everyone else. You have your revenue minus your cost of goods sold, CGS, and that gives you your gross profit or gross income. And then you have minus operating costs, and then you have this thing called depreciation expense, DEPEC. And that brings you to operating income, operating profit or income, otherwise known as EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes. Then from there, you subtract interest expense and you get to income before taxes. Now, in my world, we call that pre-tax. You'll hear me, income before taxes, you'll hear me call it pre-tax. But then you subtract your taxes and you get the holy grail of net income, profit. And every talking head you will ever hear will talk about profit. Well, their profit was higher this year. Their earnings per share were higher this year. Isn't that great? Or their profit was lower. Their earnings per share was lower. Whatever. They talk about profit as the holy grail. And we in finance don't give a rat's ass about profit. We don't. Here's why. See all that down there? A lot of that is not operations. For example, interest expense. That's not an operating expense. You're never going to say, well, I paid my interest to the bondholders this year, so boy, are we going to be more productive because I did that. No, you're not. It doesn't have anything whatsoever to do with operations. This line up here, depreciation expense, it doesn't exist. You don't write a check to depreciation expense. I always wanted to make a corporation called depreciation. So everybody had to write me a check. It doesn't exist. Now, we keep it in there for a while because it does create a tax shield. Even though it doesn't exist, it protects some of your revenues from taxes. But then once we've gotten that taken into account, we throw that out. Anything that is not an actual operating expense is not part of what we care about. So what we have to do then is say, okay, those rivers are carrying silt, sticks, other stuff that is really irrelevant to the body of water that is going to be created at the end of every year to represent this corporation's health. So all that matters to us is free cash flow. What happened? Can you pay your bills? As I mentioned in a previous class, I ran a corporation every other Thursday night. I had to cut payroll. That I was profitable on paper, very profitable, but I didn't have enough free cash flow to write the checks. And so I had to keep going to my own savings account to make sure there was enough money so that I could make sure that my employees were able to get their checks, pay their bills. Otherwise, they would have walked out and that would have been the end of the corporation. Never mind profit. All that mattered was how much scratch was available to make it to the next operating period. And that's why we care only about free cash flow, not about profit, because it's got all that silt, the sticks, and whatever else was being carried into the balance sheet down those rivers from the ancillary financial statements. We'll go through those on Wednesday, but right now I want you to get your attendance logged in. And once you have gotten your attendance logged in, you can start the quiz. And I will put the password on the board. And once you're finished with the quiz, what time is it now? Okay, in 3 minutes, the quiz will open. And once you are finished with the quiz, and make sure that you stay here, don't open the quiz and then just take off. You do it in here, mobile phones put away, no talking, we'll get this done. But when, by the way, if you don't know it, you're allowed to use written or type or printed notes on the quiz. I said that in the announcement. But once you're finished with all of that, you get the quiz done. That's all I have for you today, and I thank you.